Hello, this is the podcast of Manchester School of Theology. In this episode, we're bringing you the recording of part two of a session with Owen Hilton on February the 10th, 2024, where Owen was getting into issues of race and the story of God. And in this episode, he's talking about the Antioch model, looking at the church in Antioch in the Bible and how it sets an example for us in what a reconciled church could look like. We hope you enjoy the recording of this episode, and you can find more from us on our website, schooloftheology.co.uk.
So what we're going to do on this particular session is I'm going to speak, and then I'll probably give you like a short amount of time to just reflect, and then we'll just have a bit more time for questions if you've got any. I think, is it 12 we finish? Okay, so we've got chill time, okay? cool, I didn't realise it's half 12. Okay, so if on the last session I was talking, you know, I was looking back a bit, looking at history and all of that, this session I'm talking about what I call the reconciled church, and we're looking at the model, at least what I see is a model in the church in Antioch. So that's our main focus, is we're going to be like in and around that. And if you like, I would describe the reconciled church as churches that are more reconciled in relationships, so relationships are made right, they're more integrated in community and more diverse in leadership. And I'm saying that that model comes from Antioch. I didn't just make that up, I think that comes from there. And I would say the biblical picture of diversity we see is it's a gracious act of a sovereign God. Its purpose is ultimately to bring glory to God through reconciling and unifying peoples from every tribe, tongue, people and nation. And this is an act. This act is a sign that Jesus was indeed sent from God. It's almost like the reconciliation of people together in communities authenticates the gospel. It authenticates what Jesus has done and the fact that Jesus has come. He, Jesus, becomes the great unifier for all those who believe. And the church needs to actively and intentionally embrace that vision and remember that the world has no equivalent means to bring unity. So whilst legislation kind of works to a degree and other things kind of work, nothing replaces what Jesus has done. In the same way that we don't believe you can be saved in any other way. Yeah, we don't. No Christian goes, well, do you know what? There are other things that can save you. We don't believe that. And I'm saying we can't. Unity can only come through Jesus. It doesn't come through other ways. Diversity and racial reconciliation are not purely modern inventions of secular society to deal with global migration and respond to changing social and cultural demographics. It's not just the latest thing the church and society have to deal with. It is the unveiling and revealing of something that was and is at the very heart of God's purpose for the world and has been on his heart from the very beginning. And that comes from my book, which was 15 years old. I didn't write it yesterday. Ephesians 3 encapsulates the point when it says, Ephesians 3 verse 9 to 10, to make plain to everyone the administration of this mystery, which for ages past was kept hidden in God, who created all things. His intent was that now, through the church, the manifold wisdom of God should be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly realms. In other words, God always intended, it was always his purpose, that one day he would display his wisdom through the multicoloured, multi-layered, and if you will, multicultural diverse church. That was always his intention. And he was displaying it to the rulers and authorities and principalities in the heavenly realms. That was his purpose. Seeing that, though, requires that we have revelation, that our eyes are opened, and that we have faith. Without that perspective, This can appear like an annoying or irritating distraction from the real work of preaching the gospel. Such revelation helps us see that it's clear demonstration that this is the power of the gospel. So different people have different perspectives on this. My view, and you won't be surprised, is this issue of racial reconciliation is a gospel issue. And you'll see that as I talk through. You might think, I'm not sure it's a gospel issue. Because obviously, if it's not a gospel issue, and it's like one of those optional extra issues that certain churches do, that's one thing. Whereas I want to put to you, no, this is the gospel. This is not just something that you do, because you've got minorities around you. This kind of openness needs to be available in case minorities come to you. So then, what does a reconciled church look like? And this is just, I hold it lightly, but what does it look like? I think there are three main aspects that I want to just identify. I'm sure that there are many others, and I'm not asking you to kind of create some kind of tick box, but I think they are foundational. Reconciled relationships, integrated community, and diverse leadership. And I think those are the things that we are aspiring to, hoping for, believing for, trusting for, rather than those are boxes that we tick. Have we got those things? So, reconciled relationships, where does that come from? Acts 11 says this, verse 19, it says, "Now those who had been scattered by the persecution that broke out when Stephen was killed travelled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch, spreading the word only among Jews. Some of them, however, men from Cyprus and Cyrene, went to Antioch and began to speak to Greeks also, telling them the good news about the Lord Jesus. The Lord's hand was with them, and a great number of people believed and turned to the Lord. News of this reached the church in Jerusalem, and they sent Barnabas to Antioch. When he arrived and saw what the grace of God had done, he was glad and encouraged them all to remain true to the Lord with all their hearts. The disciples were called Christians first at Antioch." So that passage is the culmination, if you like, of several encounters where the gospel crossed different divides and brought healing, reconciliation, and hope. And in this final encounter, we read, they began to speak to Greeks. And we can't even begin to imagine how massive that would have been in first century Judaism. That they began to speak to Greeks. And it wasn't, they weren't being separated by all the things that held Jews different. They just began to talk to them. In some ways, I think it's one of the most significant moments in the New Testament, even though it appears innocuous. There's no one named here. It's almost like, by the way, they began to speak to Greeks. But Jesus had promised the gospel would cross divides and cultural barriers. You know, when he says to his disciples in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, "You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth." When Jesus says that, he doesn't unpack what that might look like, but we know what that will look like. Jerusalem, okay, we understand it. Judea, Samaria, what does he mean? We're going to be witnesses in Samaria. They're our enemies. Why? What is he talking about? What does he mean to the ends of the earth? In their minds in that moment, they're thinking, oh, we're going to reach other Jews in other places. That's what they're thinking, and that's what they do. Don't they? They leave Jerusalem because of persecution, and they simply take the gospel to Jews only. That's what they do until they get to Antioch. So the gathering, even in Acts 2, when we talk about the gathering of Jews from every nation under heaven and that supernatural ability to understand different languages, some people would argue that that moment in Acts 2 is a reversal of the moment we read about in Genesis 11, when the Tower of Babel happens. We see the Tower of Babel, and God, what it says of the people, and this is interesting, the people had a common language, common speech, common purpose. So the people are together, they're common, they have everything in common. And then it says they decide, oh, let's build a tower to God. And God says, what do they think they're doing? And he confuses their language and he scatters them across the earth. Yeah, and he scatters them out of, if you like, out of punishment. It was a judgment on them. It wasn't go bless the earth. It was a judgment on the people. Why? Because in the Tower of Babel, what you discover is the unity that they had, the commonality that they had, was a commonality in which God was not central. So as a result of God not being central, he judges them and he scatters them. Yeah? But, and what happens then? Just Genesis 11, Genesis 12, what immediately happens? God then promises Abraham, I'm going to bless you and you're going to be a blessing and I'm going to bless all nations through you. Yeah? So he always intended to bless the world. He just wanted to do it his way. Yeah? Not our way. So Genesis 12, you get the promise. Genesis 11, you get the punishment. Genesis 12, you get the promise. The fulfillment of Genesis 12, if you will, and the reversal of Genesis 11, if you will, is Acts chapter 2. When all nations, what does it say? Every nation under heaven is represented. Now, whether or not it's strictly every nation under heaven, it's representing something to us. That all the nations have come together, and in that moment, all the nations have come together. God doesn't scatter them, he gathers them, and he brings his Holy Spirit among them. It's something different. It's the opposite of what they had believed. Then in Acts chapter 6, when we read about the Grecian Jews, the Grecian widows and the Hebraic widows, and there is this discrimination. You can read into it if you will, but there is this discrimination around the distribution of food between these two groups of widows in the church. There's a discrimination. And it's very interesting to see how the church deal with it. The problem is brought to the apostles. And the apostles think about the problem. We focus a lot on the fact that the apostles say, oh, we mustn't give up meeting, you know, we mustn't give up the word and prayer in order to do this. We kind of focus on that. But really what's going on there is there's this discrimination that's happened in the church. And then the apostles and how they deal with it. And they deal with it well. Yeah, they deal with it well. And they say, okay, how are we going to deal with it? And they set out Greeks to help. The thing I find really helpful about that passage and why I think building a truly reconciled church is missional is in Acts 6, verse, I think it's 7, it says, as a result of what happened, a large number of priests come to faith. And the church continues to grow. So in a moment where they heal a divide, the church grows. There's blessing on the church. Why would priests come to faith? Let me just speculate, because I don't know. The passage doesn't tell us. Let me just speculate. Why would priests come to faith when they see what happened in Acts chapter 6? Maybe it's because they knew that problem of the difference. They knew that there was a discrimination and they didn't know how to deal with it. Maybe. I don't know. I just put that out there. But people are saved. People are added. Acts chapter 8, where we read about, obviously, the gospel goes to Samaria. And then the Jews, Philip, meets the Ethiopian eunuch, who people would say he represented the ends of the earth. What's God telling us in that moment? He's telling us when Jesus talks about you're going to go from Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria to the ends of the earth. Within a few chapters, they've gone to the ends of the earth. Yeah, but they haven't gone to the ends of the earth, but the gospel has. The gospel has. So we see that. And then, you know, in Acts 10 and 11, you see Peter's encounter with Cornelius and all of those things. I won't kind of go into that so much. But there are a couple of things that are worth mentioning about the moment in Antioch when they come together. First of all, Barnabas says he sees evidence of the grace of God. So something is happening in that place, which Barnabas goes, oh gosh, God is here. There's evidence of his grace here. The other thing that's important about that passage is it says the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch, which means Jews and Gentiles together are labelled in the same way. They're labelled Christians. Yeah, and that wasn't a label they gave themselves. They didn't turn around and say, do you know what, we're going to be Christians. We're going to be little Christ. That was like a label that was given to them. Of their Christians. They're little Christ. They follow that Jesus figure. Yeah. What's interesting about that is we know the history of Jews and how they were set apart from Gentiles because of circumcision, because of ceremonial food laws, because of all these things, they're set apart. And yet in this moment, Jews and Gentiles are considered in the same way. That's quite a powerful moment in the history of the church, that people don't see them as distinct anymore. They're seeing them as coming together. It's the grace of God that's at work in their lives. Christ has reconciled Jew and Gentile to himself, and he's brought peace. And if you like, Antioch is an example of it. So we see that right at the beginning of the church in Antioch, these things happened. And then what does Barnabas do? It says that he goes off to Tarsus to get Paul, and he brings Paul back. Maybe Barnabas is thinking, Paul, you need to see this. You need to see what is happening in this place. Because you kind of talked about this kind of, but maybe this is something to be seen. So he goes. So that's the first thing, reconciled relationships. And we need to find our way of reconciling relationships in our world with all our differences. Yeah, because remember, for the Jews, the circumcision, the food laws, the ceremonial days and all of that, they were fundamental to their identity. They weren't offshoots. You know, they were fundamental to their identity. They were the things that separated them out from the Gentiles. They were the things in their minds that God had given them to keep them distinct. And yet in this moment, God has kind of moved all of those out of the way. And he says, oh no, the way that you come to me really is through faith. Yeah, that's a massive change. And then I think about some of our cultural things, the things that we think are important. How many of those things are we willing to give up for the sake of the church being truly reconciled? And just throw that out there. So the second, remember I've talked about reconciled relationships. The second thing is integrated community. This is what it says in Galatians chapter 2. When Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they arrived, he began to draw back and separate himself from the Gentiles because he was afraid of those who belonged to the circumcision group. The other Jews joined him in his hypocrisy, so that by their hypocrisy, even Barnabas was led astray. When I saw that they were not acting in line with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in front of them all, you are a Jew, yet you live like a Gentile and not like a Jew. How is it then that you force Gentiles to follow Jewish customs? I don't know how you've grown up understanding that verse, but for me, that verse has always, you know, the major point of that verse has always been, how do you deal with conflict and confrontation between major senior leaders and da 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 da? How does that kind of work? With Paul and Barnabas, or with Peter and Paul. And often that's where we focus. But when I look at it, when I've looked at it, particularly recently, it tells us something very deep about the nature of the community in Antioch. It tells us something about it. It was integrated. It was integrated. People from different backgrounds, Jews and Gentiles, were sharing table fellowship. They were eating together, something that historically the Jews would never have done. You know, they would never have ate with them. When Peter goes to Cornelius and Cornelius invites him in, the first thing Peter says is, thanks for inviting me, but you know that Jews never associate with Gentiles. So why have you got me here? That's the first thing he says. And yet here he is eating with Gentiles in Antioch. He's eating with them. And so you're finding this table fellowship is happening. Table fellowship, if you like, is symbolic of the work of the cross because it puts people in the same place. It puts them together. Yeah, people who otherwise would never eat together are eating together because of the cross. Peter's eating with the Gentiles because of the cross, not because he's hungry and because it's the Jesus thing. Jesus has brought them together. And yet there is still this pressure upon him and others not to go there. Yeah, because the Jewish law expressly forbade eating with non-Jews. Yet here in Antioch, it appears that this is a normalized activity. Peter's engaging with it. Other people are engaging with it. It's challenging, but it's normalized. Peter enjoyed freedom and relationship with the Gentiles. And yet we see how deeply rooted cultural values and expectations are, so that when certain people come from James, Peter withdraws. Peter steps out. And I don't know what that looks like, but you know, maybe we're all here and a certain group come from James and they come in. And even though I'm leading, I'm now also fearful. Oh, what am I going to do? So Peter withdraws. And so Paul challenges him. And he challenges him publicly, not because he wants to embarrass or shame him, but because what's at stake here is massive. What's at stake is massive. If you do that, if we begin to do that, then all hope is lost here. If you aren't able to express this freedom that the gospel brings in eating with people who are not like you, with the Gentiles, all hope is lost here. The gospel frees us from conforming to cultural norms and expectations, especially when they draw us away from cross-cultural fellowship with other believers. Culture is important, and your culture is important, but it is not sacred. It's not sacred. Where the cross and culture meet, culture must die. Yeah, where you end up in a situation where your church, you realize, oh, there are people who are kind of pushing into our church and they can't get in. Where it's your culture that's the barrier, you've got to go, guys, we need to deal with that. We need to deal with that thing that we find really important, but actually it's not the gospel. It's not the gospel. And this is what was going on among the Jewish believers here. They attached such a lot of identity to those very things that they then had to give up for the sake of the gospel. Circumcision, food laws, ceremonial days. We must ensure that our culture doesn't become the barrier to true reconciled fellowship. We must find a way. The other thing that you note here is that there's a gravitational pull. And we need to acknowledge this. There's a gravitational pull that we can have towards people like ourselves. Yeah? So I could be in a church that on a Sunday looks very diverse. But after week six, I realize, oh, they all sit there. They all sit there. And outside of the Sunday, they never talk. Yeah? So there's a gravitational pull to people like ourselves, which the gospel breaks down, the wall of hostility. Yeah, the gospel breaks it down. But Peter was experiencing that gravitational pull along with others at Antioch. As I say, I've heard of many, many churches where the people are diverse, yet the people in the church draw primarily into relationships that like themselves. Which is, I think, one of the reasons why in so many churches that are diverse, we struggle to bring leaders of diversity into the church, really, because we're not used to building those relationships. Yeah? Because in our kind of church, in many kinds of churches, leadership comes out of relationship. Yeah? It comes out of people you know. I mean, I've been on a staff where we go, oh, do you know so-and-so? Oh, yeah, he's a great guy. Yeah? That's how we would make decisions. Yeah? Oh, he's great. Yeah, let's ask him. Do you know so-and-so? Oh, no, we don't know them. Yeah, and do you know what? When I sat in those meetings, I discovered that most of the people we didn't know were from minorities, and the people who we did know looked like us. Yeah, that's what I discovered. That's what I saw. I was like, oh. Yeah, and we found building relationships with people who were different to us more draining than building relationships with people who were like us. Yeah, we found that. And so the leadership, if you like, the kind of leadership conveyor belt just was the same. And it took a very, very, very special individual to break through that. And then suddenly they're the example. You know, oh, look, yeah, we've got a black. Look, that's the guy. Yeah, we need to create in churches multiple pathways for multiple people. Yeah, we just need to do it slightly differently. So that gravitational pull happens. Paul confronts Peter, and it's interesting, he confronts him with these words, "You're not acting in line with the gospel." Those are the words. So when we talk about this being a social justice issue, I'm like, where does that come from? Because it doesn't come from the Bible. Paul tells Peter, when you withdraw from fellowship with people who are different to you, you're not acting in line with the gospel. What the gospel has won, you have denied in that action. The crossing of divides is a witness to the power of the gospel to reconcile us and bring peace in our relationships. The other thing, and please, I don't know what happens up in, you know, say in Manchester. I know this from my own experience down in London. And so please don't, you know, you don't make it a personal thing. I remember when I was on sabbatical a few years ago, and you know, I was having a sabbatical, and in fact, I was on sabbatical. Pauline wasn't on sabbatical. She was working. And the first 2 or 3 weeks of the sabbatical, I thought, gosh, how's this going to work? Because normally I get up earlier than Pauline, and I get up and I go pray, whatever. But when I was on sabbatical, I thought, do you know what? I'm just going to lie in a bit. But Pauline was like banging around and lights are on. And I was like, how am I going to do this for 3 months when, you know, every morning Pauline's just going to be up and about and it's noisy and everything. And I wasn't sure what was going to happen. Anyway, I'm sure it wasn't deliberate, but there came a point where one day I was visiting different churches. And I mean, in the end, 3 weeks into my sabbatical, Pauline fell down the stairs and she broke her ankle. And so my sabbatical was spent looking after Pauline. To be honest, I loved that. That's true, my love, isn't it? Yeah. And we watched Death in Paradise and other things. And so it was we had a great time. But one of the things I did is I visited a church. I visited a church in a different part of London, not far from me. And I went there because I was visiting different churches. And this church was a large, I think it was predominantly Nigerian church. It was large, 500,000 people, big church. And I went there and, you know, we're singing and I da 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 da. And 98% of the church were like black, African, you know. And then there came a point where I can't remember whether I read it on the board or that someone said it, but they were talking about, there's something about celebrating their 60th year. I thought, wow, that's interesting, because I'm thinking 60 years ago there was this Nigerian church here. Wow, I didn't realise that. Anyway, so the story went, that church didn't start out as a Nigerian church. It actually started out as a, you know, typical, maybe white evangelical church. Over the years, it had become more and more black in its congregation. And then there came a point where every white person left. So if you came to that church, you would have thought that this church had prayed and asked God and he'd given them a building because it wasn't being used anymore. But that wasn't the case. This church went from being white to being black. And then I bumped into a guy who I know who was one of the leaders, this black guy, and I said to him, I'm really interested. I said, I visited your church during my sabbatical. What happened? He said, oh, yeah, after a while, and his the end comment was, in the end, the thing that people found difficult to accept was when black leadership began to emerge in the church. That was the point where people began to kind of leave and not stay. And I remember in my own church, we had a situation that, not Beacon in the church I was in before, we had a situation where we're talking about these issues and, you know, you might not realise this. I didn't want to talk about these issues. Yeah. So that, my background wasn't, I want to talk about that. That wasn't me. But in the end, kind of the way God worked, I ended up talking about these issues. And I remember a friend in my previous church, there were two comments that got made. One was, if you keep talking about these issues, Owen, you're going to split the church, you will. You'll split the church. And then later I was told, now we're in the time where we need to allow other people to take over. Yeah, and we'll step aside. And my comment to her was, people don't want to take over. They just want to join in. They're not asking you to move out. Yeah, they're asking you to be with them. And you think back historically in different places where legislation stopped people being together. And so this thing of people leaving the church, this gravitational pull, this lack of integrated community is massive for the church. And so in 2024, beyond, our hope is that we can do this differently. Our hope is that we can do this differently and that we can be humble enough to build those relationships, genuine relationships around that whole thing of table fellowship, so that we don't do what Peter did. We don't withdraw. We recognize, do you know what, we have to put some things down in order to pick some things up. And so then the third aspect of the reconciled church, reconciled relationships, where we put integrated community, is diverse leadership. That's what it says. Again, we're looking at the story of Antioch, the church in Antioch, where in Acts chapter 13 it says, now in the church at Antioch there were prophets and teachers, Barnabas, Simeon called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Manion, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul. While they were worshipping the Lord and fasting, the Holy Spirit said, set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them. So after they'd fasted and prayed, they placed their hands on them and sent them off. The account of the leadership team in the church at Antioch provides us with another unique insight into the church. The team represented many ethnic, racial and cultural differences. Simeon, called Niger, is African, likely black African. Lucius of Cyrene was a Hellenistic Jew. Manion was brought up with Herod. Maybe he touched royalty or the upper classes of society. Barnabas was also a Hellenistic Jew and relatively wealthy. We know that he sold a field and brought the money to the apostles, while Saul was raised as a radical Pharisee. If the church had such a diverse leadership team, how much more would this have been reflected to some degree in the church community? Yeah, because leadership often reflects the community. Often leadership sometimes is the last thing to reflect the community. But it reflects, it's meant to reflect the community. Surely the inclusion of such a diverse church experience in reconciled relationships, integrated community, in the scriptures gives us a clear and wonderful example of what church can be. This group, to some degree, must have put aside their natural and cultural differences to come together. And they're not coming together having a big discussion about stuff. It says, whilst they were worshipping the Lord and fasting. And you remember what I've said? Always keep Jesus central. It's the only thing you've got that really holds you in common. Yes, there can be other things, but that's the main thing. Yeah, so they're worshipping the Lord and fasting. And it's in that context that God then speaks to them. They've put aside some differences. It can be no coincidence that the mission of the church, which went around the world, comes from this place. If you think about it, the church we read about in Acts 2, we often talk about the Acts 2 church, and you see that bit at the end of Acts 2 when it talks about they had everything in common and all of that, and they're listening to the apostles' teaching. And that church is not the church where the mission goes from. That church only enters the mission through persecution. Yeah? They are persecuted, and because of persecution, they are scattered. Yeah? Some of them end up in Antioch, and in Antioch, it's God who speaks to Barnabas and Saul and says, set them apart for the work I've called them to do. So when Paul and Barnabas leave Antioch, surely in their heart is a picture of a church that is truly reconciled. They've seen something. Surely this is where we're going. Yeah. So Paul is committed. He already knew, though, didn't he? Because when he got saved, God says, you're going to be a voice to the Gentiles. You're going to the Gentiles. That's what God says to him. According to Harvey Kriani, who writes a book called Multicultural Kingdom, he says 92% of churches in the US are mono-ethnic. 65% of churches in the UK are monocultural. And yet, in Antioch, the first missional church is diverse. What's happened? The first missional church is diverse. And yet in 2024, we struggle with that same kind of diversity. We struggle with it. What's happened to the church? It almost at times, sadly, feels like the church has rebuilt the dividing walls of hostility that the gospel destroyed. That we've rebuilt them. We might not have known we were rebuilding them, but we kind of have rebuilt them. You know, when we justified slavery because the church did that. When we backed eugenics because the church did that. And many other things. I don't want to go into all of that. So just back to that point where Paul speaks to Peter and he talks about your actions of withdrawing from fellowship with the Gentiles is contrary to the gospel because you're putting back another brick in the wall. The wall that Jesus broke down, you're rebuilding. In the 21st century, surely we want to remove the wall. I mean, the wall has been removed theologically, but it's not been removed necessarily physically or philosophically in the way we think about church. Why have churches changed? Why have they gone back? Why are there so few genuinely diverse leadership teams? Why are not more churches shaped by the diversity that's within them? What is it? What is it that we're doing or not doing? So just a few points of application. Leadership development needs to be intentional and principled. I'm not saying that we don't base it on relationships, but there needs to be something more than that. We've got to recognize what Jesus has done. And how he has brought us together and what that means for us. Leaders often find developing relationships with others who are not like themselves more draining, prone to mistrust and prone to miscommunication. Yeah, because from some backgrounds, you're kind of waiting for the leader to ask you. In other backgrounds, you're stepping forward to volunteer to help. Yeah, and so we've got to just be aware, okay, there are differences. Yeah. The answer to, oh, there are differences, isn't, well, do you know what, we haven't got time, we've got the mission, we've got to do this, so we'll just leave all of that and we'll go with it. And if people go with us, they go with us. That can't be the answer. Yeah, because in the sovereign purposes of God, he's brought people to you for the very purposes of helping you. But it's helpful for us to be able to acknowledge that unconscious bias that we have towards leaders who look like us, sound like us, do what we do. You know, if I came into leadership, first of all, by putting out chairs and praying in the meeting and all of that kind of stuff and doing whatever I was asked to do, and I think that's how it happens, what do I do when someone joins my church who's not like that? Yeah? Or if when I go to church and people, you know, commitment because people join your prayer meeting on a Wednesday night once a month for an hour and a half, and I discover that, oh, some people, they don't join the prayer meeting, but it's not because they don't pray. And in fact, maybe they pray in ways that could really help us. Yeah, maybe there's faith and courage that we don't have that they're expressing. So question, just how do we avoid things like tokenism and favoritism? As I say, the way to avoid tokenism and favoritism is to create multiple opportunities for multiple people to take on leadership responsibility. And over time, create more organic pathways for lots of different types of people. So have ways in which people can do it. Don't just have one way. Have different ways. Okay, so then just coming into land here. So three potential barriers to us building the reconciled church. First one is pragmatism. We just want to prioritize what appears to work over what might be right. You know, oh, this works. you know, the church is growing. Why focus on things? Why focus on that? Things are going well. God seems to be blessing us. And I don't want to decry that, because it's wonderful if that's happening. But lots of things grow that aren't great. Do you know what? Weeds grow. And they grow faster than flowers. Yeah? So if you don't dig them up, yeah, I know this, unfortunately, from things in the garden. If you don't dig them up, they grow and they can spread very quickly. Growth itself is not the sign. Yeah? If your church is going well, it's not the sign. Even if within that you've got people from minorities going, oh, we just think it's great, it's wonderful. I'm not saying that there isn't that moment where it might be great and wonderful, but we all know things can appear great on the surface and there are still things that need to be dealt with underneath. We know that to be true in life. So pragmatism. Let's think about, do we want to prioritise what works over what is right? Traditionalism. We want to protect and preserve our values. When we feel things are under threat, we double down on what we believe. And sometimes our values, the very things that we hold to, are cultural. They're cultural. They come out of your culture. They don't come from the Bible. Yeah. When you find a family from another place coming into your church and you see that they parent different, they pray different, and they use money differently, yes, you can think to yourself, I wonder when they're going to come around to our way of thinking. Or you can go, oh my goodness, people do things differently. And that's okay. That's okay. So traditionalism. And then the third potential barrier for me, my observation, is pride. We just refuse to listen and believe. We want to do the thing that we want to do. And so we make that the priority. God is a God of reconciliation. And he is relentlessly committed to his own purposes and his own promises. And he's made a way through the gospel for the church to be reconciled, not just to him, but to one another. And that is a witness to the world. And the question is, are we committed to that? Or are we not committed to that? Because in the modern world, that's kind of where it's heading. It's kind of where it's heading. I remember, just tell this last story and then we'll do some group stuff. I remember listening to a message from Duncan Campbell. So Duncan Campbell was involved in the Hebridean revival in the 1950s. And I remember him talking about the evils of the television. And I remember he spoke about the evils of the television, and then he heard about this man who got his TV and he threw it out. Because it was like, yeah, evils of the television. And it was like, I kind of get it, but the world's going there. How are we, the church, going to best use what's coming our way? You can't just throw it out. You know, because I bet you that man, not long after that, goes and gets himself a television. Yeah? And if not for himself, because his kids are like, Dad, everyone's got a TV. Yeah? You know, we can do that. We can hold on to a principle. And it's like, okay, God, this, you know, I don't know what you're doing in this. But sometimes, and it's not that we want to compromise, but sometimes the world's going in a different place. And I would say this, that the race, reconciliation, diversity thing, though, it's going there. Whether you want to embrace it or not, it's going there. You know, we have literally been to the four corners of our nation. We've seen churches that are very, very diverse. It's happening right before our eyes. And yet, we go to the scripture and we don't go, what does the Bible say about it? We go, oh my goodness, he makes a way for this. Right at the heart of the gospel. And so then we can go, thank you, Jesus. Because if you didn't make a way for this, I don't know what we would do. But he does make a way for it. And so that's the thing that we are to embrace. I know Pauline went round with a cup. If you've got any questions in that, then you can just hand it up. And oh yeah, so Paul, there's one over there. You can take it. So these might be questions that you want to ask, but you want to ask them slightly more anonymously. Okay. So if we've got groups, individuals, if you just put your hand up if you've got questions and. Tom, work, come round, and I'll just mix these in with the other questions.
It's been brilliant, by the way, what you've shared, Owen, and I'm sort of like, it's sort of all sinking in. So I want to ask a question because I want you to stay with us. And I'm thinking of a question. But one of them is, you know, you say, like, create multiple ways for, like, multiple different people to join in. I think that's so great. Have you seen any ways? Because often when you see something, you're like, oh, I can do that. Not that it's formulaic, not that you copy, but it's just, you know, when you see something and go, sometimes it's that easy where you just go, do you know what? You can do this instead of just doing that. So have you seen anything that you're like, I love that this church is doing that. That's fine, because that's brought up a new leader that they wouldn't have built relationship with.
I mean, I think first off, it's worth you in your own context just thinking through and being like, just reviewing yourself. How do we bring leaders through? You know, are there different ways? What do we actually do? You know, my point in the end, most of us just do it around relationship. That's how we do it in church. So things you can do, which maybe, so even things that say I've done in my context. So I have found, how do I put this? Let me try and do it this way. You know, I keep talking about keeping Christ at the centre, keeping Jesus at the centre. There are four things that as churches we should all do all of the time. This is our basic bread and butter, because it draws people into us who are different to us. That is, we need to read the Bible together, we need to worship together, we pray together, and we do fellowship together. But we do that around Jesus. Yeah, I think, first off, if you focus on doing those things, you will draw people in who are different to you. Because I might have got saved in Ghana, but it's still Jesus who's my Lord. So when I come here and you're reading Exodus chapter 3, I know that. Because that's what I've been reading. Whereas if you're reading, I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but if you're reading John Tyson, a different book, or an alpha book, I might have to do a number of leaps in my head to get to that. Yeah. So I'm saying, as much as you can, focus on the thing that really brings you together, and that is Jesus. So you focus on the Bible, because that's Jesus. You focus on worshipping Jesus. You focus on praying to Jesus, and Jesus praying for you, and you focus on fellowship because of Jesus. So I think if you do that, over time, you'll build relationships that bring people through. I think that. The other thing that I know that I've done is, be at times as a leader or a leadership team in a church, you just need to be a bit more courageous. Yeah, so you be a bit courageous and you go, do you know what? You know, we need someone to do this role or that role. Maybe these. I often have leaders who, not one leader, maybe it's a couple or a couple of people or two or three people to lead. So I'm getting people to lead in teams and then creating space for that to work. So you might go, X and Y are picking up this team, everyone. And what we're going to do is we're just going to run it for 6 months to see what happens. Yeah. You create space from people in your church going, oh, are they really the right people? Are you sure? Da, 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 da. Because that will happen, particularly if they're not like you. And you say, oh, let's just see how it goes. Let's just give it some time. So you create space, you create that. Thirdly, I would be talking, because I'm a great believer that in your church, God has placed the people to help your church become what it's meant to be, the unity, the maturity, the growth, and all of those things. So where you've got people in your church who are not like you, particularly where they've been coming for a while, lean into them, but just relationally, lean into them. What would you do here? How does it work for you? Just lean into them, ask those kinds of questions. I would do that. I run Bible studies and devotionals with lots of different people, and what I find when I do that is I get to know people. There's a relational aspect of that, but there's also just a theological aspect of that. We get to know how we think differently or what we think. I would sometimes, I mean, it can be a lot of work, but I will sometimes create opportunities for people to lead stuff. So now, you know, if you're in the Anglican Church, this might be different. But for a while, for a long while, when we used to do communion, I'd get somebody to come up and explain it. And so that could be any number of people. I would do that. Or get people to run Bible study groups. So you don't need to do a 2-year course to run, maybe let's look at the Bible together and pray. So I would do things like that. But I would keep the focus around the things that are central to the church that you would be doing. If you were doing church in New Zealand or in Ghana or anywhere, you would do certain things. You would pray, you would read the Bible, you would worship God. You might do those things slightly differently, but those are that's the focus. Other things are secondary to that. So I would be building it around that. I don't know if that really helps this long. But. Any other questions? I'm going to sneaky. Manav, why don't you have a read of these? And then, I know you're not answering them, but just have a little read of that. And you can tell me this.
Hello. So there was a point you made about traditionalism and sort of my church background.
Sorry, what was there's a point I made about?
Traditionalism.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. Sorry about my accent.
No, it wasn't it. I didn't hear the word.
Fair enough, then.
It wasn't the accent.
Softener.
It was,
So I was just asking more from the perspective, less about race and more about values and tradition in terms of, I'm from a Coptic Orthodox church. Yeah. So in practical terms, because I know there's a split, when you talk about the church, I suspect you're talking about kind of like the Western way of worship and that kind of church. So what, in practical terms, what would be the best ways of uniting kind of like the different sects as they were in terms of kind of like the Western way of worship, the Roman Catholicism way of worship and Eastern Orthodox? Is there any practical way of bridging that gap?
Yeah, so I'm not saying, so again, this has been a journey for me. I'm not saying that every church has to do this way, yeah? What I am saying is if you go to any church, probably there are aspects of what they do that people are held out, which are not because of what they believe. It's just the culture, it's just the way that church works. So if I think about, say Black Pentecostal churches, yeah, I'm not saying that, you know, Black Pentecostal churches, they shouldn't be there. They should all be in our... I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying, though, is maybe there are things that they can learn that can draw people into them, and there are things that we can learn over here that can draw people in. So I'm not kind of going there's one size fits all, but there are principles that happens in church, because the Bible... I know there are differences and we've got different versions, blah, blah, blah. But essentially, the Bible is the same. Yeah, whether you're here in the UK or you're somewhere else, the Bible's kind of the same. The stories are the same, you know. And what I'm kind of pushing towards is, let's at least have our eyes open to the fact that sometimes we can culturalize the Bible to our culture, and that bit we've got to stop doing, partly because God's bringing people to us where that's not the case, and it's exposing the fact that that's what we're doing. We didn't know we were doing that until that. And I'm also saying, my bigger issue, I know your question wasn't about race, but I'm also saying, and there are things in the past that we just have to resolve better. Yeah, so I'm not trying to shut down this church or that church. Interestingly enough, you know, Tom talked about the breadth of people in this room. When I've gone to different places to talk about race and diversity and reconciliation in the church, we have had every kind of church represented. Literally, every kind of church represented. Whether it's Black Pentecostal churches through to, you know, kind of Catholic or whatever over here. Every single kind of church has been, because it's an issue for all of us. Reconciliation is a thing. And it should be a thing because, you know, 2 Corinthians 5, 11 to 18 says, he has given us the ministry of reconciliation. That's why I think it resonates in our hearts. So, yeah. Again, I don't know that I answered, but... Oh, okay, yeah, read me the question as though you're the person.
Should reconciliation, integration and leadership formation
Okay, yeah, good question. So I think it's a both and. I think it's both and. It needs to be intentional, you know, in 2024, because if we don't intentionally do it, we just won't do it, because it's not part of the way we do church. Maybe in 2044 it will be less intentional, because the church will be a bit more, you know, so it needs to be intentional right now. It might not always need to be intentional, but we have some redressing to do.
I just wanted to go on the back of the previous question, because we were talking even in our groups. I've been thinking for a while that it's kind of like, as church, we need to understand the kingdom better, so that we can understand our common things of what is our core to our faith, in which you've mentioned. And by doing that, I think we also start to create a kingdom culture that is prevalent more as a first culture within us as a group of people, as church across the world, so that we can actually then have that kind of mindset of understanding we're all human, we're all, you know, and to understand how do we reconcile, and seeking the Spirit and praying and doing those core things that are bringing us back to Jesus, and Jesus at the center, and always going back to the Word, not just our opinion or our intellectual tradition or anything else, but let's challenge ourselves and keep going back, because we've had lots happen in the church, and God has brought things through the different parts of the church as it's moved on, you know, and he's restored lots and they've done different things, but we can learn from each other, you know, if we have that intentionality to, as part of our culture, to love one another as ourselves, then we're going to want to actually reconcile and find ways. We're going to want to actually do all the things. We're going to want to put Jesus first. We're going to, you know, it comes from that point. And I think that's really key. And I think we've got to keep looking back at what the scripture says and really looking at that and asking Holy Spirit to give us revelation so that we can unpack these and find that way of developing that intentional culture that's kingdom, that we're known kingdom first rather than I'm Nigerian or I'm English, white, British, yeah. Or I'm a traditionalist, I'm a Catholic, I'm a whatever. It's like, no, we're followers of Jesus first. And this is something we can learn from each other on our cultures, but we've got to make this as our first culture. Yeah. You know what I mean? So that's just, I'm thinking a lot about it in the last few years, so I'm just really interested in what you're saying, so thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. And I think, I mean, if I'm really honest, and it's not to, it's not complex. It's challenging, but it's not complex. Because you can be a Christian anywhere. You can come to Jesus anywhere. The bit that is challenging is how we come to Jesus together. That's the bit that's challenging. And we would have been fine. It's almost like we could have said to Jesus, why did you start global migration? Why didn't you just leave us all in our places? Because we'd have happily been Christian where I am. But he has done global migration. It's a God thing. It's not just economics. It's God. In order to display something. So it requires the church to be able to respond to that. The issue isn't complex, but it is deeply challenging for us. So, yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay, yeah.
Okay, this is a question on behalf of someone else. How do we unlock the dialogue with our church family whose experience is of being treated differently because of race, ethnicity, without making them responsible for defining the changes that others, primarily us white folks, need to make? How do we unlock the dialogue with our church family whose experience is of being treated differently because of race, ethnicity, without making them responsible for defining the changes that others need to make, others being primarily white folks?
Okay. So I think that the way I, you know, often talk to people about, so, how do you go about making change? How do you make change in a situation? How do you unlock things? So the way I approach that is I pray into change. So I don't say that lightly. Yeah, so I don't say that, oh, well, yeah, okay, pray, but what else? I pray. Yeah, prayer is a big part of how we build the church. And I'm asking God, help me here, help me. Yeah, in that kind of context, I might be saying to God, help me to find a person of peace who I can talk to. Yeah, help me, God, that I might learn. Bring them. And if you don't have those people there, then I wouldn't worry about it. I would just be praying, and God will bring the right people. I'm aware of churches, I mean, maybe in Manchester, maybe in other parts, where they've got very significant leaders from other parts of the world in those churches. Yeah, for me, God does that, and you're to honour that in your context. So I'm praying. The second thing is I'm recognising that everyone's on a journey, and the journey for the for those who are in the ethnic minority, the journey for them is a slightly different journey. Yeah, I did a Zoom call with a group of church leaders from black majority churches. I did a Zoom call about reconciliation. Before I started, there's banter, they're laughing, they're joking. When I began to talk, there's deathly silence. Yeah, this for them isn't choice, game, options. This is reminding them of pain, difficulty, rejection. And some of them were like, I don't need to do that. I'm okay. And also, if they're in a context where they want to bring about reconciliation, but actually the people they want to reconcile with don't see it, get it, understand it, you do that once and you don't do that again. So it's quite hard in that kind of situation. There is a bit where there's an onus to be able to lean into it. So I wouldn't necessarily open up big journeys and conversations with people. I might publicly talk about, you know, we do a little group where we talk. We use this phrase: lessons we've learned and I'm learning about race. So we're running this thing, and I might talk to my church. Oh, here are some lessons I've learned and I'm learning about race. And so I'm not going to an individual, I'm just talking, I'm just saying things, my journey. I think that can unlock things for people, that can open things up for people to feel like, oh, okay, that's interesting, I'll see what pastor or what they're doing about that. So that's kind of how I would do it. I wouldn't be trying to approach people directly. I would be praying, I'd be talking about lessons I'm learning, and I would be trying to, you know, be an example to my church. I would be trying to be an example. And then I think it wouldn't take long before people would want to talk to you about that. Because it's real for them, but people aren't going to just engage with it because they think, oh, okay, this is the moment. They just need to give time.
Okay, this is the last anonymous question. What is the difference between monoracial and monocultural?
I suppose monoracial and monocultural, I mean, I've never thought specifically, but obviously monoracial would be a church where everybody's of the same race. Monocultural would be a church where the culture is embraced, but people might actually be of different racial backgrounds and different situations. So there are some churches that are people of the same culture, but they're not all of the same colour. And I think that does happen. Doesn't mean that, yeah, so I think that does happen in churches. So.
We have a couple of churches who use our building. One's an Indian church, one's a Romanian church. What's your reflection on, you know, we see it with Hong Kong churches as well, what's your reflection on those communities, you know, what's healthy, what isn't healthy, and what would you hope that they would do over time?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, and so the interesting thing about that question is you get churches that are like that everywhere, and even if you in the UK you'll have like a Romanian speaking church and maybe a Congolese speaking church or whatever. I mean, it's probably worth just noting that we kind of do a similar thing often when we go abroad. You have international churches, which are normally often English-speaking, and we understand that church and stuff. So the expats, that we do it over there, and people do it here. I think that my now reflection is fine. That's part of the journey. The journey of the church broadly is some people will see this and some people won't see this. I understand it. What I would say that the challenge of it is you can find yourself preserving culture over preserving faith. That's what you can end up doing. But your practical reality might be people speak Romanian here. So, you know, what do we do? And maybe there's an expression of faith in Romania that isn't as easily transferable. So in that sense, I understand it. Probably what I would want to do, though, and we did this because, you know, in our church, we meet in a premises of a school, and there was another Spanish-speaking church that met in a different premises of the same school. And I remember in my heart thinking, oh, I'd love to do something with them, but I don't know how. I'm not, you know, it's going to sound a bit twee, me running up saying, oh, can we have a meet? So I didn't do that. But in my heart, I was praying about it. And then there came a point when we were told that we couldn't use our premises I can't remember, there was a week we couldn't use it. And somebody in that church I knew, and so I approached this lady and I said, look, we can't use our premises on a particular, could we just join you? Can we just literally come and be part of it? And they were like, yeah, oh, that would be great. And we went from, we're just going to join them, yeah, to, oh, but could you preach, Pastor? Could we do this? So I'm like, okay, we're really like, we just want to join you. And so it was very interesting because so then we had a meeting in their space with them. My daughter, who kind of helps to run our worship team, she went and did worship practice with them somewhere in East London and was massively challenged because Saturday morning, they gathered every Saturday morning to practice for worship. She was like, wow, that's like commitment, you know? And so then we came together and it was really interesting because we sang a combination of songs in Spanish and songs in English, but it wasn't a, you know what I mean when I say, it was real. People were worshiping in their space. And I loved that. And then I preached and then I had an interpreter and I was talking to her before. I was like, will this illustration work? I don't know. And so I'm talking to her before. But I preached a message on grace. And just got some wonderful feedback, and I was, for me, it was just encouraging that I could connect and that kind of thing. And so even gently wanting to offer that, I love to be able to do those kinds of things because they were really, it was very real for them. We learned a lot. I learned a lot, certainly, about doing that. And so I think there are ways that we can lean into it, like kind of in a grace-filled way without trying to make a big thing of it, and I would. But fundamentally, in 2024, there are churches like that, and that's okay. Because over time, maybe some of those kinds, you know, people will see a bigger vision, but right now, that's okay. Those of us who do see it have that level of responsibility to engage and push forward, and hopefully it brings about change, but I do understand it. I mean, one of the most powerful things around it, and one of the reasons that some of those things will change is because of the next generation, because they're not the same. And so we ended up in our church having some young men come to our church who grew up in really cultural environments going to church, and they had decided in those cultural environments, oh, God's not for me, because that's not my world. And then they're exposed to, oh my goodness, God is for me, because they're just exposed to it in a different way. So the younger generation are not necessarily the same, but yeah.
Because when you've got different congregations like that, that obviously makes you think a little bit about church unity movements. And from what a lot of what you've been saying today has been making me think about church unity across churches within say or where I am. Have you got any reflections about that and whether there's principles that we can use to help work together with other churches?
Yeah, so I think two things about the application of say some of what I've talked about today. I think there are three ways that we try and apply it. First of all, what do I need? What changes does Owen need to make? Secondly, what changes can I bring about in my own church and congregation, where I have influence and carry? And then thirdly, what can we do broader? The reason I say that is not to kind of dodge the question, but more my everything I'm telling you about how I understand the church, I'm to some degree trying to work out in my own local church context. And then, as I say, with that Spanish-speaking church, I was very much aware of all the things that I say about it, but I knew I can't just rush into this. How do I build a relationship? I pray for opportunities, though. And so if I've got two other churches meeting, if I had my own building, I had two other churches meeting in my own building, the first thing I might do is go, should we, as leaders of these churches, meet every so often just to pray, just to catch up, just to pray? Yeah, because, you know, if you're leading a church, it's the same. There are going to be similarities, and providing you can get the language thing going, I would build relationships that way. And then in time, that might lead to other stuff. But that's probably how I would do it. I would just say, you know, should we do that? Because it might be that it's a transactional relationship. We hire your building, you leave, we come in, da 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 da. Whereas you could make it a bit more than that. And I probably would try and do that for the very thing of unity. But I'm not trying to think, how do I bring unity tomorrow? It's how do I build relationships that allow us to pursue unity together? That's probably how I would do it. And are there ways that I can support, not immediately help and give money or whatever, but how are there ways that we can support one another? That's probably how I would approach it.
A couple of hands. We'll take these two and then maybe these the last two.
I was interested in your sort of slightly throwaway remark when you said global migration is a God thing.
And sorry, I wondered,
global migration is a God thing, is what you said.
Throwaway remark.
And I just wondered if you could expand on that a bit, only because people in our churches read different sorts of newspapers, listen to different sort of news. There's false news all around, and those discussions do happen, but how do we help people to see God at work in that area?
Yeah, so for me, a big part of that is my really deep belief in the sovereignty of God, that God's in control. Also my belief in, you know, in Acts where it says he determines the exact places people will live. Do you know what I mean? So I think God is at work, that nothing happens in this world that God is not involved in to some degree, hard as that might be, that nothing happens that God isn't involved in. And so I think the reason I say it is because what I see happening is people moving for all sorts of reasons. People are moving around, entering in different places. And what it's doing, it's creating an opportunity for the church that was not otherwise there to manifestly demonstrate the power of the gospel and the beauty and the broad picture of the gospel. Only God does that. We don't do that. Only God does that. And also, it brings us to the place where we need to sort stuff. We're forced to face things. You know, one of the reasons that Archbishop Welby talked about the power of reconciliation is because he travels the world. And when he travels the world, he's hearing what the church have done in different places. And he's like, oh, this isn't easy, but we've got to do something. So I just think it's what went out is coming back, and that's a God thing. And even more a God thing sometimes, because we're not in control of it. It's just happening. So, so it's he determines where people live, that it's the sovereignty of God, that nothing happens in this world that God does not have a hand on in some way, however difficult that might seem to us. Sorry.
A little bit sorry to have to end with this question because it's a bit of a tough one, but
no.
If you put this, you know, we've got the context of the church coming together, all being reconciled. You know, when you put that in the context of Revelation, where Jesus judges the churches, two questions. Do you believe that all churches will reform, reconcile, and come back to God? Or do you feel in some cases certain people need to be looking to move on from their church to find one that is doing this?
Okay, yeah, good question. So, I mean, obviously, I'm not here to advocate people moving on from churches. Yeah, that's not my... And in a way, my principal approach is pray, be an example, talk about things that you've learned. And so that's how I do it. I also live big by Isaiah 64:4, since ancient times, no eye has seen, no ear has heard what God will do for those who wait for him to act on their behalf. For me, that's quite a big... So I don't move on from things willy-nilly kind of thing. Having said that, you might find you're in a context where you go, do you know what? I either am going to give myself to this place, and if I do that, then these things that maybe God has put in my heart, are just not. I'm going to have to let them go. Or I'm going to have to just trust God, and yeah. So I do think that clearly does happen, but I think broadly it's God's scattering this to the church. Some will pick it up. It's the seed, isn't it? Some falls on good ground, some falls on stony ground, some will fall on good ground, and because some falls on good ground, the church will ultimately change. Because the church that's restored that we talked about at the beginning, some people will know absolutely resisted that. And in fact, the house church movement in the early kind of 70s and 80s and 90s in the UK, the biggest criticism of the house church movement at that time was, well, you're all into yourselves, into the home, you're not involved in world mission. Well, the house church is massively involved in world mission now. Do you know what I mean? So God has his way of bringing about his plans and his purposes. And so I don't get stuck on these people don't, these people do. I'm like, okay, God, I can present what I'm presenting here. Some seed will fall on good soil, and in 10, 20 years, they're going to reap a harvest. And some might not. And you know, in a way, I walk away from here with that kind of attitude. Some will be good, some might not, but it doesn't. I don't necessarily make that a personal thing. I don't know if that fully answers the question, but it's how I've answered it. Okay, Tom.
Let me pray. Jesus, we thank you for the gospel. We thank you that you've reconciled us to yourself and that you reconcile us to one another. And Lord, I ask for each of us as we think about the outworkings of that truth, as we try to live it out in our lives and our churches, will you help us? Will you open our eyes to what we're not seeing? Will you open our hearts to people who are not like us? And will you help us reflect the glory of the beautiful bride that you've bought for yourself? Amen.
Well, hopefully you enjoyed this teaching and found it really beneficial. If you'd like to know more about the Manchester School of Theology, or there's any way we can serve you, please do check out our website. It's www.schooloftheology.co.uk. And we'll be back soon with more theology content hitting your podcast feed.